Well, thank you. It was mentioned in the introduction that I'm involved in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and one of the pleasures I received this morning was a spreadsheet with 6,000 governmental comments on the draft synthesis report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now, I'm not going to admit to having read all of the 6,000 comments before I came here today, but on a quick skim, I couldn't find a single one that questioned the science behind the climate change that Sir Mark mentioned in his presentation. I'm going to talk more about some of the mitigation issues about Working Group 3, but we do talk to all our colleagues, and I'm very convinced by the Working Group 1 report that took three different lines of evidence, one on observation, one on attribution, and one on modelling, to quite clearly, in my view, demonstrate how to disentangle anthropogenic effects from other influences, like the sulphur dioxide that was emitted in the middle of the 20th century, like solar cycles, like volcanoes, like the amount of heat that is going to oceans as well as into the atmosphere, which may explain much of the hiatus that we've seen over the last decade. So what worries me, coming from the Working Group 3 side of it, is the speed of the change that we have seen. It is absolutely unprecedented over geological time to have seen this rate of change that we have over the last few decades. But specifically, what I wanted to mention were three things. I wanted to mention the link between human activities and future climate change. I wanted to talk a little bit about costs. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the role that a country like the UK would play as part of a wider global effort. So the Working Group 3 report for IPCC that came out earlier this year was quite explicit that if current trends in energy use and the growth in energy use continues, we will expect to see temperature increases globally of between about 3.5 and 5 degrees during the 21st century. And Sir Mark has, you know, given some clear idea about some of the, what the consequences of that would be. 190-odd countries have signed up under the UN Framework Convention for Climate Change, saying that they're aspiring to keep global temperature increases below 2 degrees. And following through the arithmetic and the modelling, it's clear that that needs very, very substantial changes, especially to the way that we supply and use energy. And specifically, there is a calculation based on a survey of 900 different scenarios that were submitted, saying that emissions would need to fall by between 40 and 70% by the middle of this century if that we were to be on target for that 2-degree temperature increase. And it's very clear that this would involve a number of changes in the energy sector. It would mean moving towards low-carbon energy supply, which could involve renewables, could involve nuclear energy, could involve fossil fuels with carbon capture and storage. It needs a very big effort in terms of trying to improve the efficiency with which we use energy, and it needs a much bigger share of low-carbon energy when final energy demand, for example, for transport or for space conditioning. Now, this is going to need very significant changes in investment patterns, with some greater investment in the low-carbon energy, but reduced investment, for example, in the development of fossil fuels. Now, the interesting question is whether these kind of changes go with the technological grain at the moment. And some of the work that we've been doing at Imperial has been comparing fairly systematically scenarios produced by a number of organisations, such as BP, such as Shell, such as Exxon, such as a number of governments. And the very interesting thing about all of them, that there are common themes running through them about greater efficiency of energy use, more use of renewable energy, more use of natural gas, and some substitution out of coal for power generation in all countries. So I think the debate is not about our direction of travel, it's about the degree to which we pursue these developments as we move forward in the 21st century. Now, the question about what about the costs of this? I mean, ideally, we would have all the information to do a proper cost-benefit analysis, weigh the costs of our impacts, the costs of adaptation versus the costs of mitigation. Now, unfortunately, IPCC has been very clear that we do not currently have that evidence at the moment. There are numbers in there about the cost of the impacts of climate change, which, however, only run up to about 2 or 3 degrees global temperature increases. And when you go beyond that, you're moving actually into completely unknown zones in terms of the costs and some of the impacts. The Working Group 3 report produces some numbers about emission reduction costs, and if we were to be on target for 2 degrees, then the costs in terms of welfare globally would be between about 1 and 4% by 2030. And it's worthwhile saying in parenthesis, it's likely to be less than that in the UK, where we have much more of a service-based economy, which is less vulnerable to impacts on energy-intensive industry. So the question is, there's that 1 to 4% globally, but we don't know the costs against which we're going to weigh that in terms of the benefits of reduced impacts. And furthermore, we're not taking account of quite a number of side benefits in terms of, for example, air quality improvements, which will be important in many developing countries, and also in terms of energy security, because a low-carbon world will be a world in which many countries are less dependent on imported fossil fuels. So in the absence of the data that you need to do a proper cost-benefit analysis, a risk assessment framework is the appropriate way to move forwards. And if you follow that risk assessment frameworks, the costs are not so punitive that it will actually involve terribly fundamental changes to the structure of our economies. Now, my third point is, you know, what is Britain doing and how in line are we with other countries? And I think, again, a very important point worthwhile making is that this is a shared problem. When CO2 is emitted, it stays up there for a very, very long time, and the impacts of emissions from one country are experienced in many different countries. It's a global commons problem, it's a shared problem, and we have common responsibilities to deal with it. And that, I think, is really the premise that's underlying the Climate Change Act. And it's worthwhile saying, as a member of the Committee on Climate Change, we have an endless track of people coming through my office at Imperial asking about how the Climate Change Act operates, because many people in different parts of the world see that as a possible model for putting in long-term measures to actually keep us on track for reducing emissions. But I guess the most important point to make about Britain's role is that we are not acting alone in this in any event. If you look around the world, you can see a number of other countries that are taking quite active measures. And we can note, for example, the Obama administration and the Climate Action Plan and the efforts to reduce emissions from power stations. There are 7 emission trading pilot schemes operating in China, and the price in the Guangdong scheme is actually higher than the price in the EU emission trading scheme. So the idea that Britain is acting alone and we are getting ahead of other people, I'm not sure quite stands up. So that's my final point I wanted to make, that Britain is not acting out of line with other countries. But if I could perhaps just finish on slightly more, a couple of more personal remarks. Economic development has brought many benefits to the world in the past and will continue to do so in the future. But at various points, there have been unintended consequences that societies have learnt to deal with by bringing in different measures. And just in the UK, I would think of the Public Health Acts in the 19th century in reaction to cholera epidemics, problems with sanitation. And in the 20th century, the 1956 Clean Air Act, which dealt with the problems of smogs. And if you do your history, you will find for each of these, there was a cycle of questioning the scientific evidence and a question of looking at the cost benefit. But at the end of the day, people came through and they put in place the measures, and nobody would regret these things further down the line now that they've actually been done. And it's my argument, I think, that dealing with climate change is very much in that tradition of dealing with these unexpected consequences of economic development. Let's not kid ourselves, it's the biggest challenge we have ever had. The effects are irreversible, there's a global dimension to it, and the emissions are very well embedded in economic activity. But I think it is the same kind of challenge that once you acknowledge these unforeseen consequences, you deal with them and take it forward. So from my perspective, the kind of actions that the UK is taking are appropriate and they are proportionate as part of a global effort to deal with climate change.